We tried to talk to people in the white community. I wasn't very successful. Others would be more successful. But it never really got beyond verbal sparring. And I sort of lost a bit of faith in verbal communication. I think you've got to be a pretty smooth talker to be able to talk somebody into making sacrifices, to talk a white person in Mississippi into giving up deep-seated fears, prejudices, fears of Negroes, fears of intimidation by their white brothers. And it's probably harder to do than selling washing machines. And I sort of came to the feeling that that maybe in times like this, you need the eloquence of an example more than words. That somehow words don't quite reach far enough inside, maybe. And I think the example of Mr. Hayes, the example of the Negro students from Mississippi who've gotten into the movement and been shot at and been jailed. First time I went to jail, it was with a boy who'd been in jail 106 times in the last 3 years. The eloquence of people who accept material privation, who sleep on floors of dirty freedom houses and eat off of $10 a week. Maybe have to buy Mimeo paper off of that too, out of that. Who are on the move in a society that's sort of stagnant in a lot of ways, that's devoting all its energy to staying the same, who are on the move anyway, no matter what anybody does to try and discourage them. This example is eloquent, and I think explains partially how they've had so much success in getting people to risk jobs and other forms of intimidation to try and vote. They see somebody there doing this and more every day, and it's eloquent. I think there are a lot of eloquent examples in the world today of people with dedication. And I think this may have been the force behind our forefathers. Don't know much about our forefathers, but it seems that they made sacrifices for their beliefs. Went against the trend of things, sacrificed freedom of motion many times, and personal well-being for their faith. Maybe. So I have this struggle between thinking that it's important to be effective in righting some of the wrongs, injustices, in our society and in our world. That every time that a kid starts off life with a sparkle in his eye and it gets dulled somewhere along the line, that's something that shouldn't be, and it's something that I should be working on somehow, effectively trying to overcome. And on the other hand, feeling that you have to be sensitive to people, that you have to have scruples about the way you act, and that you don't get into the bind that I feel a lot of revolutionaries get into, of putting effectiveness up as the only criteria for action. Perhaps you don't get to the end you want to get to. I think there have been a number of things happening in Mississippi this fall that have been very encouraging, that have shown to me, I'm biased, the effect of the eloquence of people dedicated, people pushing, people trying to break down structures that inhibit their fellow men, white and black, and keep them in behind walls. In Macomb, Mississippi, many of you may know, seemed to be one of the sickest little towns in this country. From the middle of August to sometime in October, there were something like 20 bombings in this town of 10,000 people. There were a number of occasions where there were two or three on one night, and the whole town seemed to be cowering. And all of a sudden, beginning of November, 650 members of the white community of Macomb signed a statement saying there should be equal access to justice, irregardless of race, creed, or position of wealth. There shouldn't be harassing arrests, which there had been, and I think this is the first time in the Deep South that any whites had spoken out in a public statement saying that the police officers were harassing people by arresting them for trumped-up charges. And furthermore, they said, you shouldn't be a member of, it was stated indirectly, but it, in effect, it said you shouldn't be a member of the KKK and be on the police force, which was a novel concept for Mississippi. I think people were forced into making changes that some of them didn't want to make. The next day after the statement was published by leaders in the community, and all the downtown restaurants were integrated without an incident. I don't think this would have been possible without the movement creating an environment conducive to change. This summer there was another group of courageous white people in Mississippi working for change, a group of women mostly centered in Jackson, who the service committee was working with underhandedly or undercover, who were called the Mississippians for Public Education. And I don't know, it's hard to estimate, but they were one of the major factors which led to the integration of the Jackson schools and two other school systems. without incident this fall. And I think they were moved also by the situation that had been created, the disorder, the conflict that had come to a head in Mississippi. And I think maybe sometimes we need to create creative disorder. We need to show by our own commitment and the potency of our own action and our own willingness to suffer how much we deplore certain conditions that exist, whether in the South or the North or Vietnam or somewhere else. We need to show our sensitivity to other people who are held down or live in chains or poverty. I think that's about all I got to say. Anybody have any questions?
How about this feeling of forgiveness? Are these Negroes that have been working a long time in the South, are they really able to forgive what's been done?
There's a lot of hate for white people among the young civil rights workers, among a lot of people.
This is the last step,
it was can Negroes in the South really forgive white people? There are a number of pretty noble church women who at least tried their hardest to overcome this sort of thing in the spirit of the New Testament. And as far as their faith would take them, which was pretty far, they were able to overcome it. But I think, one of the things that was said in the orientation session to going to Mississippi was that by Robert Moses, who was the head of the project, was that we have to realize that this country has a plague, the plague of prejudice between the races. And as in Camus, the plague, where in the town of Oran, people were dying off at a great rate from the plague, but it took a number of days for the public officials to officially recognize that the town had the plague, because it would have meant that people would have had to take drastic steps to overcome it. They would have had to seal off the whole town from commerce with the outside and taken all sorts of stringent public health measures to try and combat it. So they didn't do anything for quite a while. And he said, in the same spirit, we need to recognize the plague that very few of us avoid, and that we can maybe only effectively avoid by just not coming in contact with Negroes or vice versa. But he said we need to face it, to realize among the staff particularly who are working together in the South that our relationships are in some degree and to some extent distorted by this societal thing, and try and work it out. And there have been a lot of hard problems, knotty problems, that have been worked out in this close interrelationship. And I think this is what I was trying to say, that we need to practice communication with people who it's hard for us to communicate with, and that, at least to me, I need practice to overcome these things. You know?
Forgiveness a very rare thing anywhere. You know, it seems to me it's a word we use very glibly, and I can't find it in my
in passing.
It's hard.
Many of us have the insight that we do have into feelings of the Southern Negro have come from reading authors such as Lillian Smith and James Baldwin. In working with the Negro Civil Rights Workers, were those ever mentioned? Would you feel that they have an empathy with this kind of modernist writing?
They were among the student nonviolent coordinating committee workers, but you know the local Negroes, few of them, read that sort of thing, and it's not sold on the newsstands or in the bookstores, and the libraries in most towns aren't open to them. That's one of the things the summer did, was bring books into the state and set up about 20 freedom libraries where people could get books to read. One thing about Baldwin, I think, is that he seems to some degree, I'm not quite sure about this point, but he seems to be dealing with the crisis of identity among the Northern Negro, where the barriers are more subtle, and where a lot of the hate that in the South is directed towards the white man, because you can see him there holding you down, is turned inward in the Negro ghetto in the North. And this identity crisis is not as prevalent, I don't think, in the South. It may become so, but it's hard to get mixed up with the identity of the white man or feel that you're in your situation because you're no good or you're inferior, because you see the barriers there so plainly. Civil rights workers, the other volunteers, or?
Well, you said that there were people who couldn't stick it out. We wouldn't be able to stay. Obviously, all of them can stay. Here we were sure that some did stay, and some of the same thing.
Yeah.
Was there positive things in that, and was that the kind of thing you
had? I was in my first week in Mississippi when the boys were lost, and this is a sort of a different reaction, I think, from up here. The Negro community was pretty calm. They were used to this sort of thing. It helped maybe to form a bond between us, but it was sort of the everyday. There'd been, in the town I was in, there'd been shootings a couple years before into homes, and a couple girls had been seriously wounded. And a couple days before I got there, in a neighboring county, three Negro farmhands had fallen out of an overloaded truck coming back from the fields and been killed. And the first week I was there, a Negro mental patient who was diagnosed as having extreme withdrawal symptoms had come and was known in the county as a sort of a harmless fellow, had come home from one mental institution and was going to another one, and was shot on the road by a state trooper And at the coroner's inquiry, he testified that the man had come at him with a knife and thrown it at him, and that the knife went, you know, 50 feet in the air or something, glanced off his helmet, and that he shot him in the head. And the jury accepted that testimony and didn't go any farther into the case. So this thing is of the everyday, and you find that, or most of us found that you get used to it, and you get to accept death, and you get the same sort of fatalism that maybe a soldier gets on the front, where, you know, my bullet will have my name on and I can just ignore the rest, you know. It's a freeing thing in a way. It can be a little spooky because you get so you sometimes don't take the precautions you should. But it frees you to work, whereas maybe the normal amount of fear might keep you paralyzed.
Michael, thank you very much on behalf of this group. I think you've gotten beneath the surface in a way that makes us feel what's going on, and this you just can't get any other way than by direct exposure. And I think this is the problem we have most with us, that we sort of have a vague feeling that we know more about it and ought to be doing something, but we aren't involved. And this emotional involvement getting through to us is the thing that we appreciate about your presentation this morning. Thank you very much. I believe we should pass the meeting now.